Radio News. It's 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Earlier this month, a group of New Hampshire lawmakers tried to intercede in a dispute between the City of Manchester and the U.S. State Department. The city wanted to impose a one-year moratorium on new refugees settled in Manchester. Mayor Ted Gatzis and others argued they were already struggling to help the current refugee population and that the city needed some breathing room before it could welcome more. But the State Department, which oversees refugee resettlement, said while it would consider lowering the numbers, an outright moratorium made no sense. Then the legislature stepped in with House Bill 1405, which would allow local governments to establish moratoria. The bill got an unfavorable committee vote, although it'll still get a vote on the House floor. But regardless of its fate, the proposal provides yet another example of the constant power struggles we see between the federal, state, and local governments. These tussles go way back to our founding as a nation, and they're very much part of our current political debates, whether over refugee numbers, President Obama's health care law, or who should have more say over public education. Today in The Exchange, who's in charge of what in this country and in our state, and why we keep fighting about it? Let's hear from you. Where do you see these power struggles coming up the most, whether it's health care or education or property rights or taxes? Why do you think we're always debating these lines of jurisdiction? What might settle these matters more clearly, or is this just intrinsic to our democratic system? Give us a call. Tell us what you think. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. With me in studio, three guests to hash out this question. Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of the popular website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And Dean, welcome. Good to see you.
Good morning, Laura.
Also with us, Charlie Arlinghouse, president of the Josiah Bartlett Center for Public Policy, a free market think tank based in Concord. And Charlie, welcome back.
Thanks.
Also with us, Buzz Scher, professor at the UNH School of Law, who teaches in the area of constitutional law. And Buzz, welcome back to you too. Thanks for being here.
Pleasure to be here.
Well, and Dean, I'll start with you. There are so many current examples. I just gave some of them in the introduction, but just remind us, Dean, how far back these debates go.
The debate over the relationship between the state and federal government goes back to the founding, essentially, to the drafting of the Constitution. There was a real concern among opponents to the Constitution about preservation of states' rights, that ceding too much power to a central federal government would be problematic for the states, for everything from providing defense and raising taxes to regulation of commerce. So this is a several hundred-year-old debate over how to have an effective relationship between these two levels of government. And in the end, the founders went with this compromise, a federal system, which was really a joint federal-state system in which the federal government had a number of enumerated powers, and the state governments had a set of reserved powers that were spelled out in the Constitution. But the nature of state power has always been quite gray and subject to reinterpretation at various level of state and federal court. So, some people feel today it's still not a settled issue. We go through these periodic cycles in the country of conservatives in particular pressing for greater states' rights. Really, it's a function of whatever is going on at the national level at the time.
So they didn't resolve it way back then, Dean. They kind of swept their disagreement under the rug and said, okay, future generations, you figure it out.
Yeah, it was basically a compromise. And, depending on your interpretation of the relationship, some people argue that, well, it was really a better deal for the national or the federal government than the states because the idea of reserve power of the states was actually fairly tightly constrained by several of the articles in the Constitution. And that's where the issue of interpretation and, precisely what can the federal government force the states to do or not do. And that's really the crux of the issue.
Well, and we won't forget the tension also between the state and local governments. But a question for you, Buzz Scher, on this idea that, the founders, we hold them up to such high regard today, but they kind of left this undone, didn't they?
Yes and no. They had tried a more state-empowered model before they got to this Constitution. The Articles of Confederation had a much weaker federal government and gave the states more power. And it became pretty clear pretty quickly that that wasn't going to work.
How come it didn't work? We hear that often. Articles of Confederation didn't work. Why not?
Because states were fighting with each other. And there was no, at least there was no empowered referee And it became clear to the founders, at least as revealed by the Constitution they passed, that they wanted not only a referee who was empowered, but a powerful enough center to make sure that the states didn't spend all their time competing with each other, that the union was competing with the rest of the world rather than killing it, eating itself
if
up.
If I could just mention to follow up on that, people should know that under the Articles of Confederation, there was a national Congress, but there was no president. There were a series of committees within the Congress that had executive power, but it was very inefficient. And the ultimate issue was that state sovereignty, that sovereignty, the power to govern, rested with the state. So there was no way to compel taxation. There was no way to compel raising of an army. There was no way to regulate commerce. And as Buzz said, you basically had these states kind of fighting with each other, printing their own currency, raising their own armed forces, et cetera. So they're really, the Constitution and this whole issue we're talking about really was driven by a desire for more central control and for, as Buzz said, kind of an executive leader.
Well, they didn't want that executive because they had
the king,
had experience with King George. Yeah, Charlie Arlinghouse, jump in here.
Well, I was going to say that I'm not sure that the founders would look back at it and think that they punted exactly. I think they would look at the Articles of Confederation and they would say that didn't work. For a couple of reasons. One is that there was no clear sense of what the federal power was and what the state power was, that there were 13 states that thought of themselves in many ways as 13 sovereign nations. And those 13 sovereign nations would have to agree unanimously on anything, or else one state would have veto power. And they said, all right, this isn't working. So what we need to do is enumerate very specific powers and say, you know what, there are some things that we should do federally, that we should do as a national, as a unit of 13 states. So let's make a list of what those things are that we're going to do federally and the way in which it's done. And at the time, and this has evolved since then largely through the way a lot of things evolve, but at the time they thought there are very limited and very specific and very enumerated number of things they're going to do, and everything else we're going to do at the state level. And there's a second aspect of that, which is the level where things should happen. We know, for example, let's use today's terms, if we're going to have a nuclear army, that's probably not something that should be done at the town level. That's probably not – we should not have a patchwork of nuclear armies. We should have one nuclear army, and that's probably best done at a state – at a national level. On the other hand, stop signs – which corner gets a stop sign? Is it a four-way stop? Is it a two-way stop? That's probably not something that should be controlled out of Washington. That's probably best done as locally as possible at the neighborhood level. Everything in between is subject to the principle of subsidiarity, which actually originates out of Catholic social teaching, but is now enshrined, for example, in the European Constitution, which is that everything should be done to the greatest extent possible at the smallest and least complex level possible. Stop signs should be done locally, for example. The difficulty comes in the interpretation of that. If I may think something is best done at the local level, and somebody else may say, you know what, I think towns are too parochial and we need to move out a step from that. And that's where all the debate and the tension occurs, I think.
Buzz, go ahead.
And much of this, to pick up on what Charlie was saying, much of this has the unfortunate but understandable problem of when it's my idea, I think it should be done in a way that gets it the most application. But when it's somebody else's idea that I don't like, boy, you know, we can't have too broad an application. So that's a very important part of this dynamic.
Let me invite our listeners to join us. And then a lot more questions, gentlemen. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Today in the exchange, who's in charge? Federal, state, or local laws? Examples abound. We've talked about some of them, whether it's refugee resettlements, public education, health care. We're looking at who writes the rules, where the lines are drawn, and why we're still debating this so many years into our democracy. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Where do you see power conflicts occurring most often? On what issues? And why do you think we're still debating these lines of jurisdiction? Our number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And Dean, following up on something Charlie said, so, okay, who controls what? The federal government. All right. Clearly in charge of national defense. Where else is there, Dean, sort of broad consensus that, yes, it's cool that the feds do this?
That's a good question. Obviously, as
beyond
you mentioned,
national
defense is the most obvious one. You know, that's the issue. The tension here is, and has always been, you know, the extent to which the federal government is able to define whether it's a social good or an economic benefit. You know, we could talk about the Great Depression and the idea that the president has become kind of the chief economic officer for the country. We had the Employment Act in 1946, which made this essentially a federal statute that the president has responsibility for the economy. But the debate all along has been, you know, the issue of whether or not the federal government can really provide social goods or economic goods to citizens uniformly across the country in ways that account for cultural differences, geographical differences, economic differences. So, on the one hand, you could argue it's important for the federal government to set educational standards, as George Bush tried to do with No Child Left Behind. On the other hand, there are real differences between educational needs of, say, Arizona versus the educational needs of a state up in New England. So, you know, for many, many years, really prior to the Great Depression and the World Wars, a lot of these issues were really considered local issues. But, you know, at some point, particularly with FDR, you see this kind of nationalization of a number of these issues, Medicare, you know, healthcare at some level, education, the economy, it pretty much reaches into every realm of social economic policy. And so that's where we get into this debate of whether or not the federal government really should have that kind of leverage. Really, other than national defense, the rest of this stuff is pretty much up for debate.
Charlie, what do you think? Is there anything else that most people would add to that list besides national defense?
Oh, I think there's probably nothing.
Really?
It's possible you'll think of something that I didn't think of before. But no, I think, you know, when we think of how limited the federal government was in, you know, let's say before World War II, and how I think Dean is right about how things changed so much during the New Deal and FDR's sort of attitude about things. There are a lot of things that the federal government took over. There's probably an open question with a lot of people about whether or not that was a good idea. And even some programs where there may be more of a consensus, although not complete consensus, about that the taxes to fund this program should be raised nationally, there's rarely consensus that the administration of that program should then also be done nationally. And there are debates about those two things in concert. Where should the taxes be raised? Where should the administration be done?
All right. And we will get into some of the specifics after a short break and take your calls at 1-800-892-6477. Keep it right here.
Good morning, it's 9:19. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from the NEEF Network organizations hosting Destination College, a college planning convention for high school juniors and parents in March. Information at destinationcollege.org. And from Pixel Media, now hiring interaction designers, information architects, .NET developers, and project managers. Details about Pixel Media's creative culture at pixelmedia.com. More on town, states, and the feds. Who governs what on the exchange on NHPR? Then a 10 on the Diane Rehm Show. Ultrasound requirements, the latest tactic in the battle over abortion. New Hampshire weather today, partly to mostly cloudy, breezy, and mild, with highs near 45 in the North Country, near 50 in central parts of the state, 50 to 55 degrees in southern New Hampshire. Tonight, mostly cloudy, low temperatures near 25 north, 30 in central parts of the state, and 30 to 35 degrees in southern New Hampshire. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the ongoing power struggles between local, state, and federal governments. We invite you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. In what areas do you see these power conflicts occurring most often? Is it health care? Is it public education? Is it property rights? Is it taxes? And why do you think we're still debating these lines of jurisdiction? Our number, 1-800-892-6477. The email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And Charlie Ellinghaus, I want to turn to you and the other gentlemen here on the panel, Dean Spiliotis and Buzz Scher. So we've talked a little bit about state versus federal, and it seems like beyond national defense, lots of gray, lots of room for debate about who should be in charge. What about in New Hampshire, though, Charlie? We talk a lot about the cherished value of local control. But when it gets right down to it, towns and cities don't have home rule, what's called home rule. Clear that up for us, Jerry.
Well, at the federal level, what happened was that states, which retained sovereignty, states were the governmentally sovereign organizations, created a federal government where they surrendered portions of their sovereignty to, without getting too into the theories of all this, but essentially they said, all right, we're going to give up these roles and give them to you. It's not the same at the local level. The locals didn't surrender control to the state government. There is a state government. And the state government in New Hampshire lets towns or delegates certain responsibilities to towns, but it delegates only very specific things. And people would argue that that's exactly the case with what they delegate to the federal government, too. But towns may do only what the state lets them and only in the way the state lets them do it. The notion of local control in New Hampshire is a vague one, is not very well defined, and is mostly unknown to people who use the word. They use the word, they're not sure what it means. But essentially, the grand theory is that in education in particular, as opposed to other things, but in education in particular, we would like schools to be controlled at the lowest level possible. That is to say that we would not like the state deciding things. We would like individual schools and at individual town school districts to make those decisions. That is also, however, honored in the breach more than in the practice, in that the state imposes myriad rules on local communities.
And I think a lot of people, Charlie, would find that surprising because we cherish so much this idea of the local body being closest to the people, and we've got our town meetings and our local school districts and so forth. And yet New Hampshire, on paper, doesn't have home rule. Towns can only do it if the state says, yes, you may.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it was a huge debate in 2000 and I'm going to say 2001, 2002, when there was a home rule amendment on the ballot.
2000.
And at the centerpiece of that debate were a lot of people saying, oh, yeah, local control. And then the pushback was, and it was frankly, it was a group of conservatives actually led by my friend Rich Killian who helped stop this notion. And the idea was, do you want a patchwork of regulation? And so there's this notion about there's some things that you should be permitted to regulate at the local level and there's some things you should not be. And then we get into negative versus positive.
So it's kind of like the Articles of Confederation. People realize it's hard to thrive economically when you have states competing with different economic systems. So let's at least be on the same level so businesses can, you know, sell in Antrim and Allenstown and wherever they might want to go in the state.
Yeah, it's fundamentally what drove it, I think.
Buzz.
And the interesting thing about it is the rhetoric is completely apart from the legal structure.
It sure is.
You know, state legislatures all the time say, you know, keep the feds out of this. We want local control. And then they turn around and say to the towns, we're in charge here. We have the authority. You operate only with our blessing and within the limits that we set. So there's a rhetorical inconsistency in how people talk about local control when it's state versus towns versus state versus the federal government. It's really interesting that way.
Dean?
Yeah, one of my favorite examples of this that I use when I teach is if you remember back with the Obama stimulus plan at the beginning of his presidency, there was all this money up for grabs, and New Hampshire got a lot of money, and we had a lot of paving on the interstates that summer, and there were the signs up, the Reinvest in America signs all over. But there were a number of conservative governors around the country, Bobby Jindal in Louisiana, Tim Pawlenty when he was governor of Minnesota, Mark Sanford when he was governor of South Carolina, who all said they were going to refuse to take the federal money, and they justified it through the 10th Amendment, which is reserve power of the states. And eventually the legislature said, oh, no, you're going to take that money whether you like it or not. But the argument was that essentially Obama was creating a new federal mandate with this sort of social welfare money, and then after the initial jolt of stimulus funds, the states would be responsible for funding these programs in perpetuity. So you had this really interesting kind of 10th Amendment debate that really harkened right back to the founding, and it's been very useful for me to kind of flesh out these principles for my students.
Our number again here on The Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Join us, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. So, guys, let's get into some specifics then. And the federal health care law, about half the states are suing. New Hampshire's not one of them, but it's also not doing what the law says it should be doing right now to get ready for full implementation in 2014. And a couple questions around this. Charlie, to you, is there, first of all, much precedent for this huge lawsuit, this many states getting together and saying to the federal government, no way?
I'm not aware of one. I don't No, nothing really on this level, certainly not in recent history, no.
And can they do this? I mean, can you say to the federal government, uh-uh, sorry?
Well, you can't. I mean, that gets into a number of constitutional debates about.
And I can see Buzz wants to jump in.
Well,
go ahead, Charlie.
It's related to the principles, you know, in sort of the early republic, the question of the things like the Kentucky resolutions and the, you know, can a state say, no, that law doesn't apply here, and Calhoun and nullification. And that's essentially been resolved, which is that you can't nullify federal law. However, the only option you have is to then sue under federal law and to say, no, this violates a constitutional principle, so this shall not stand. But you have to sue over it. You can't just go, yeah, we're not going to do that.
And you have to win.
And well, yeah, you yeah, exactly.
Buzz.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, the cute lawyer answer to your question is, can the states do this? Sure, they can, but it doesn't matter if they don't win. The federal the doctrine that's at play here, the legal term for it, is called the preemption doctrine, which basically says when the federal government has legitimately occupied an area of legislation, states cannot pass laws that conflict with those federal laws. So if the federal law says this is the way you're going to manage this part of health care, the state government can't pass a law that says, no, we're going to do it a different way. Or in the example of the refugee resettlement, you know, there's a federal legal framework for resettling refugees managed by the State Department, by the executive branch. And it is inconsistent to say for the state of New Hampshire to say, no, we're going to enforce our own moratorium. So the preemption doctrine is the fancy word, says feds take control.
Well, you use the word legitimate, Buzz. Is it legitimate if states have grievances against these laws, and about half of them do with this health care law, is it then legitimate for them to go to court and try and change this?
Absolutely legitimate for them to go to court. The question becomes, in the technical level at the in terms of health care, is it within the commerce power of the federal legislature to regulate health care? And that will be one of the key technical legal issues. If you look at what the court has done over the last 70 to 100 years in that area, if they follow their precedents, it's clearly appropriate. But that may change.
Our phone number again on the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. And as we look at these power struggles that keep coming up, federal versus state, state versus local, we want to hear from you. Where do you see these conflicts occurring most often? Why do you think we're still having these debates so many years after our Constitution was put down on paper? 1-800-892-6477. And first up is Michael in Concord. Go ahead, Michael. Thanks for calling.
Good morning.
Morning.
I want to make 2 points. The first one is that it wasn't simply the inability or the failure of the so-called sovereign states to cooperate that led to the Constitutional Convention. If you read Madison's correspondence, he was absolutely appalled by the behavior of state legislatures, to the extent that in Philadelphia, he proposed that the federal government have a veto over any state law. And that was as much a driving force behind the creation of the federal government as the lack of cooperation. The second point is the extension of federal responsibility, it seems to me, grew directly out of the racial problems and the fact that southern states' governments systematically discriminated against large numbers of their citizens for over 200 years.
Right. Michael, thank you so much for calling in. What do you think, Charlie, first of all, on that first point?
Well, I want to the point about the federal veto, and it, there were a lot of different thoughts at the Constitutional Convention, which was called, in theory, to amend the Articles of Confederation, we should point out. And, you know, what Madison thought is not necessarily how the document, it's true he's the author of the draft that eventually became the Constitution. But what he thought is not necessarily what eventually happened. And the notion of an overly strong federal authority where they might have a veto over state laws was explicitly rejected by some people, and a great deal of the opposition to the Constitution at the beginning from you know, people like George Mason, let's say, the anti-federalists, if you will, was over that notion that if you create this federal authority, it will eventually become, frankly, what it became today, that they will eventually have more power, and we want that strictly limited. The response by the Federalists at the time was, no, this is strictly limited. This is not what Michael from Concord thinks it is.
What about the other point? And I think I'll turn to you, Buzz Scher, and then I got a question for you, Dean.
Sure.
His second point, that this expansion of federal responsibility was partly due to the fact that Southern states had a record of denying black people their civil rights.
I think it's that's a part of it. And that's where, you know, the most severe states' rights contest ever in the history of the country occurred, the Civil War. So the 50 state governments suing the federal government over health care is nothing compared to the Civil War. That's the ultimate dispute. Let me add a perspective. When the people writing the Constitution were worried about a centralized federal government, the most immediate specter they had in mind was the British king.
Right.
And they had no experience with a centralized federal government coming from within them. So there's limits in how we think about federal government. We don't think about federal government as somebody across the ocean. We think about federal government as Washington, D.C. So the analogies back to the 18th century and what they were thinking work only so well in that regard.
Dean, your thoughts?
I was thinking about this as we were talking about the whole issue of slavery that was raised in the call. And, you know, it really is the case in the Constitutional Convention. This was an issue that they dealt with at some level. They came up with a 3/5 compromise in order to figure out taxation and representation. But they essentially kicked the issue down the road. They said no final disposition on slavery till I think it was 1808. We have some additional crises in the South with nullification in the 1820s and then the Civil War. So I think absolutely, in some sense, you see this kind of evolution towards greater federal control as a means of, you know, finally having to bring this issue to a head almost 100 years later from the initial compromise.
Charlie.
I think one of the things the caller's referencing, though, is the civil rights struggles of the 1950s, where black people, although not slaves, were denied essentially on some level personhood. And it's the shameful behavior of states at that time that delegitimized in many people's minds for many decades the states' rights arguments. I'm a big believer in states' rights. But it has been, for those of us who believe in state rights and who are not racists, it has been an enormous struggle to get over, to say, look, we're not talking about George Wallace in the doorway. What we're really talking about is whether things are best regulated at the state or federal level. But the caller's absolutely right. That, for decades, delegitimized states' rights.
Well, Michael, thanks for adding into our discussion. And you can join us at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. As we look at these ongoing debates over who's in charge, federal, state, local, give us your thoughts and why you think we're continuing to debate these lines of jurisdiction. Also, what might settle these matters more clearly, or is this just intrinsic to our democracy? That's the way it was set up. 1-800-892-6477 is our number. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. So, gentlemen, we talked about the multi-state lawsuit against the federal health care law and asking whether, you know, can states do that? Is there a precedent? How about this one, Buzz Scher? The federal DOMA law, the Defense of Marriage law, says nationally marriage is between one man and one woman, but half a dozen states, including New Hampshire, allow same-sex marriage. Your thoughts on this conflict, Buzz, and why the feds haven't made more of a big deal over states conflicting with that federal law? Why they haven't said, New Hampshire, you can't do this?
Well, traditionally, marriage has been regulated at the state level. It has for, you know, 200-plus years. So federal involvement in marriage regulation is a very new thing. And interestingly, it's at least currently, has come from the more conservative members of the federal government in the House of Representatives.
So why have DOMA at all? Is it not worth the paper it's written on?
Oh, no. It makes a huge difference in the allocation of any federal benefits whatsoever. So it has a powerful effect, but it is the federal government stepping in to regulate that which they at one level have paid a lot of attention to, who gets federal benefits, but at another level have never paid attention to, who regulates marriage between individuals.
Dean.
Yeah, this is a very interesting issue where you see a real split among conservatives. You have social conservatives who are quite comfortable with the idea of DOMA and that marriage should be defined at the federal level. But you have other conservatives, in particular libertarians who are states' rights proponents, who, when pushed, will say, well, this is a states' rights issue. If states decide allow gay marriage, then that's fine. That's as long as it's decided by the state. And then within that, you get into the even more local issue of, well, should the legislature should decide? Should the courts decide? Should citizens vote on some sort of referendum? So there are different ways to decide it at the state level. But the bigger issue is the split between social conservatives and states' rights proponents. And it's always interesting to me when a conservative is kind of put on the spot with the issue. Are they going to go the states' rights way, which in theory allows gay marriage if the state so decides? Or are they going to go that this is a religious issue of defining marriage as one man and one woman?
Charlie?
Our experience in New Hampshire was that John Sununu, who is a proponent of both states' rights and is a strong social conservative, was opposed to DOMA for that reason, that it violates states' rights. And he said, look, I'm against gay marriage, but I think that's not the federal role. There's a tension on the part of any legislator at any level between what they think is a good idea and whether it's appropriate for them to do. And we saw this. We see this most notably with this, where social conservatives who would like the federal government to stay out of their business want the federal government in their business when it's something that they support. And a great example of this was George Bush. George Bush had an education law in Texas that he thought was wonderful. And whether it was or wasn't, we can get into
no
a debate
behind.
On And he said, you know what? This is such a great law. I'm going to make every state do it. And for decades, Lamar Alexander, when he ran for president, had said the president should talk often about education and do nothing because it's not his job. But he should use the power of the bully pulpit to speak regularly about it. And so from the standpoint of, I'm the hardcore conservative on the panel here, but it's difficult when you're in power to resist the temptation to legislate your good idea. And if I were dictator for a day, I'd make a law on everything. But I'm not dictator for a day, and I'm afraid somebody else is going to be, and I don't want them to pass the law either.
And I go back to what I said earlier. It's when it's my idea, I want the broadest application possible, and when it's somebody else's idea. And that's the beauty and the agony of the Constitution. It is set up to permanently provoke these discussions. It has split authority at the federal level among the legislature, the judiciary, and the executive branch. It has split authority between the federal government and the state government. And they intentionally set it up that way. And arguably, they intentionally didn't resolve things and say, this is the way it always has to be. It's going to be a permanent discussion of ideas.
The beauty and the agony of the Constitution. Very well said, Bashir. And coming up, I want to turn from these federal-state conflicts to some conflicts we've seen here in New Hampshire between the state and local governments. We'll also keep taking your calls at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Stay with us.
I'm Kate McNally, inviting you to join us for the Folk Show this Sunday night, when our guests will be fiddler Jordan Terrell Wysocki. Jordan was one of the founding members of Jam Antics and most frequently plays with the Dusty Gray Band and the Tom Lanigan Band. He'll be participating in the New Hampshire Acoustic Music Association benefit show on March 4th at the Tupelo, and we'll have a preview. That's Jordan Terrell Wysocki on the Folk Show this Sunday night, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from PSNH, proud supporter of a University of New Hampshire study on New Hampshire habitats and wildlife. More details can be found at www.extension.unh.edu. And the Music Hall in Portsmouth presenting an Intimately Yours concert with the Temptations, featuring founding member Otis Williams, February 24th at 8 p.m. Tickets at themusichall.org. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow in The Exchange, New Hampshire's Education Commissioner, Virginia Barry, is here. You can join us with your questions for Virginia Barry before the program at exchange@nhpr.org, and then join us tomorrow morning live at 9 for that conversation. Today, recent and ongoing power struggles in the Granite State over federal, state, and local control. Join us with your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477. Where do you see these conflicts coming up the most, and what do you make of them? Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And gentlemen, let's go back to the callers. Derek's calling from Heartland, Vermont. Hi, Derek. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, good morning.
Morning.
The main reason I'm calling is because whenever we're talking about regulation and whether it's federal, state, or local level, one of the things that seems to be left out an awful lot is the consideration of the increase in population that the country has gone through in general, and also at all levels of government.
So when you have an increased population, Derek, that means what?
Well, you have, you know, we're talking about when the founding fathers were founding us earlier on, and you're talking about comparing that to the country today. And when you have a small agrarian culture, it's a really vastly different situation as far as regulation and as far as people infringing on each other.
And it would be hard for them to imagine some of the situations that we're in today. It's a great point. What do you think, Dean Spiliotis?
Yeah, this is something I talk about with my students. I try to get them to understand that, you know, back at the founding, you had 13 states. There was real concern among opponents to the Constitution that you couldn't have a single government that could, you know, fairly and equitably represent the interests of what they consider to be a fairly culturally and economically diverse territory, basically. Now you think, you know, think how big the United States is now, not only in terms of territory, but in terms of population. And you do hear this argument that, well, you know, you need the federal government in order to ensure some kind of equity. The populations are more diverse. Economic circumstances are more diverse. We're existing in a more globalized economic environment. You know, at some level, the grassroots are important and kind of local decentralized control. But I think what Derek was saying is that the world's just a lot more complicated, and you need somebody at the national level to kind of be an arbiter to some extent in order to ensure kind of an equity of benefits.
Well, and the flip side of that, Charlie, is in a bigger society, more complicated, more people, the flip side is local control makes even more sense because you're closer to those many people instead of this huge federal government overseeing, you know, these huge many millions of people.
There's some things that we couldn't conceive of there being enough critical mass for when there weren't as many people that there are now at the town and local level. One of the other changes that I think the caller doesn't talk about but is worth noting is the tremendous apathy that has taken over. One of the difficulties in regulating some things at a very local level is the unwillingness or lack of interest in people of actually participating in that activity. You look at our town meetings. We have this glorious romantic notion of town meeting government, which nobody really participates in. You know, the rates of attendance at town meeting are, you know, a few percentage points, and, you know, 90-95% of New Hampshireites don't bother, either don't have the opportunity or just don't bother. And you know, that also leads to questions about whether this is the right choice or not the right choice.
So if people at the local level aren't participating and aren't paying attention, should we give them this power, Charlie?
Well, on some level, for some things, you should, and some things you shouldn't, and it's hard to keep track of, and you want to avoid sort of tyrannies of small minorities.
Yeah, Dina, can see you want to jump in.
Yeah, I do.
Buzz,
just a quick aside. It's interesting that Charlie mentions that because in the Federalist Papers, you know, Madison and Hamilton writing make the argument that, you know, the talent pool at the national level is going to be better than what you sometimes see at the states and the local level. So even
they
back,
said that.
Yeah. Even then, back then, they were sort of concerned that, well, you know, people making the decisions in the states, not always the sharpest talent. But you aggregate this up to the national level, and the most talented people are going to rise and run the country. So there is this sort of enlightened vanguard argument, even way back in the founders, that, you know, sometimes the local level talent pool is not quite what it needs to
it's
be.
It's kind of snobby, though, too.
Yeah,
isn't it?
It's absolutely an elite notion of leadership.
And boy, did they turn out to be wrong.
Yeah, and you hear that at the state level about local government. You know, we can't have these, you know, rogue towns doing X, Y, and Z. We gotta impose some discipline here from the state level. I mean, going back to, you know, the idea of well, we had it all figured out back in the 18th century. in terms of the criminal justice system, I mean, there really wasn't much of a criminal justice. There were no organized police forces in the 18th century when the Constitution was passed. So this idea of, you know, do we want the state police? Do we want the FBI? Do we want a town police department? It was just a non-issue that now is all over the place.
Charlie?
It has to be said, though, that one of the things that doesn't change is that principle. And what is the principle that you apply to making that determination, whether it's something that existed then or exists now? And that principle, and I go back to subsidiarity and things like that, is can this be effectively done at the state level, at the local level, with the resources we have? Is it best done there? And there's no question about stop signs, for example. There's no one who would think the state could do stop signs better. And we need to think about ourselves. We need to be applying those principles rather than just saying, I don't like the result I'm going to get.
So, gentlemen, we have about 10 minutes left. So I really want to spend a little time with you focusing more on some of these local state conflicts that have come up. And the current legislature has been criticized for taking away the authority of cities, towns, school boards. I'm sure you all saw the Concord Monitor's recent headline. It said, for GOP reps, not so local control. How fair, Dean Spiliotis, is it to say that this legislature has been especially interested in usurping authority from cities and towns?
It's a little bit of a loaded question. I think I was certainly not so much comparing to other legislatures, but I think it absolutely is the case that, you know, in this particular, I think anybody who has served on either a planning board or a local school board kind of knows the ideological cross currents at work in the state. So I think there has been an effort, curricular aspects and some other aspects of municipal government to, whether we're talking about individual rights, to change the relationship. And, you know, that's as everybody has pretty much articulated at this point. Local control is good if the local control is doing, what you're interested in doing. I know there was, I think a House committee recently dismissed a bill about Bible study in the local schools. There was another local bill about, if the school adopts an international baccalaureate curriculum, you have the right to pull your kid out of that school and have your child pay to go to a different program. So there are these kinds of sort of micromanaging of curricular decisions, and that fundamentally on both sides, whether it's progressive or conservative, those are ideological arguments about kind of what's the appropriate focus of the local level.
Why have elected school boards buzz if the state is going to say teach this, not that?
No need to.
And that gets back to that tension we talked about earlier about the state saying, well, those local people, they're okay, but
and it's that tension between the rhetoric that, you know, there's a romanticism that comes with local control that is delightful, depending on what position you're in. If you're on the school board and you can help get your kids through the school system in the way you like, it's wonderful. And, local control is great at the legislative point, from a state legislative point. But, I think this, to go back to what Dean was saying, this instinct from at the state legislative level right now in New Hampshire comes, much of it, not all of it, comes from this idea of deregulation. I think that's the overarching principle, for example, not letting towns, there's a bill about not letting towns require businesses to have fire sprinklers. I think there's a very powerful instinct in this particular legislature for deregulation, and the local control, state control piece is just the mechanism through which that plays out.
Well, on the other side of this, though, Cordell Johnson with the New Hampshire Municipal Association, Charlie, said in this Monitor article, he didn't see this legislature as any more or any less intrusive than earlier legislatures. Summing it up this way, and this echoes what you guys have said all hour, everybody's in favor of local control as long as the locals are doing what you want them to do. So your thoughts on whether this legislature is really any better or worse than any others in terms of taking away some of the power of towns and school boards?
No, every legislature includes a handful of busybodies, and I think that this is no different. It's just that so many Republicans have spent so long uttering the word local control until it has almost no meaning, that people are free to pile on at this point. But when the municipal association says it's about the same, there's a principle here. When I'm in charge, I want everybody to do what I think. So I think somewhere in that article, there's a state rep who is in favor of the state not telling anyone what to do ever. But he's got some ideas about teaching math. And you know what? That's a great idea. And I say to people all the time, that's a really, really, really good idea. But what happens when you're not in charge and somebody else wants them to teach something else? And the problem is when you're the guy in charge, you know, it's my chance to make the rule. And yeah, I agree on principle, but I can make this right. And I had this experience once that no one else should have to go through. And so I'm going to fix it. And people go to Concord and they want to become fixers. And I gave a speech about a week ago where I said, you don't want to become fixers. You want to just shut up and stop and back off when it's your turn. And remember that you're not always going to be in charge.
What's different about this legislature is there's a lot of new first-time legislators given the election in 2010.
As we saw in 06, a lot of new Democrats.
Very much so. And this group is very much feeling the power of being a legislator, to pick up on what Charlie said. And the back-off part is a hard message to get to them.
Let's see if we can get one more call in. And Ray's calling in from Suncook. Hey, Ray, thanks for hanging on. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, thanks so much. I was thinking about exactly what you guys are talking about, the local control and the school board and the local school district. And in many states, a school district, a single school district for the entire, you know, within the state is larger than the sum of all of the students that attend all of the 80 school districts that we have in our state, or 80 plus, whatever the number is. And so does it make sense from an economics perspective, from a coordination perspective, from an economies of scale perspective, for a paying the number of superintendents and assistant superintendents that we have the local control pushed as far as we do?
So maybe there should be a statewide school board that sets the policy. Is that what you're saying, Ray? Or?
Well, I'm asking the question because we're talking about the role of the state versus the federal government versus the local government. And in New Hampshire, we pride ourselves on local control, but we've already had the discussion this morning from your panel as to how few people attend the different school board meetings. Before I became a member of the school board over in Barrington 10 years ago, I was like the only person that attended most meetings, and that was because I was the representative of the budget committee who attended the school board meetings. So, you know, the question about local control has a cost perspective because all of these separate school districts have a superintendent and often an assistant superintendent, you know, as well. That creates a lot of additional bureaucracy and costs, and do we really benefit that much from it?
Right, and Ray, we've looked at this particularly in other shows. We did one a couple months ago, I think, on this idea of regionalization. Some people, Dean Spiliotis, say, hey, you know, the school district of Phoenix, Arizona is the same as the entire population of New Hampshire, so do we really need all these school districts overlapping each other?
Yeah, you know, I think Ray raises two issues. One is this efficiency argument. You know, we often read in the newspaper at town meeting time, you know, some small number of people making fairly large decisions about the expenditure of property taxes. And you may think, well, why don't we just aggregate up a little bit and have a more meaningful number of people voting on any given decision? So that's part of the issue. The other issue, aspect of the issue is this issue of bureaucracy. And there's a lot of research on education that talks about the hardwiring in of bureaucracies that, you know, Charlie was talking about everybody being fixers. Well, when you have fixers from different parties alternating control of power, they all take turns kind of hardwiring in their sort of bureaucratic notions of state versus local control. And you get this kind of piecemeal bureaucratic sprawl over time that is very hard to undo. So people just kind of keep adding to it to sort of fix things in their direction. So I think those are valid points. You've got the kind of aggregate argument, and you've got the bureaucracy argument.
Charlie, did you want to jump
in there? There's a tension in any sort of administration between the need for efficiencies of things like purchasing power. Let's all order paperclips together, and we see this at the state level.
We see more and more of that going on.
Well, there's a big move at the state level to centralize a lot of functions, centralize HR functions, centralize purchasing functions, centralize other functions. On the other hand, at the policy level, in education in particular, there's a move towards site management, where instead we don't want the school board even making decisions. We want principals making decisions. We want each individual school to be almost an island unto itself in making the decisions about what's working right there. And I don't mean the principal should be the dictator, because in my case I mean parents and principals working together and all of that kind of thing. But there's a difference between the administrative function and the policy function. And it's not necessarily the case that those two need to be at the same level.
And interestingly, the ultimate version of the aggregate up theory, or what Charlie's talking about, the efficiency theory, is the federal government. You know, you get more at a certain level, you get more efficiencies if you deal with it at a national level than if you deal with it at a local level. But as a policy matter, we can't stomach that concept.
Well, and you don't get the responsiveness sometimes. I mean, we've seen that with the problems with people's mortgages. You know, they call these big banking companies instead of going down the street and saying to the local banker, hey, I got a problem. They're on hold forever. They can't reach a real person. So the aggregation, yes, it created efficiencies, but people can't get a response. So
what we do is very often the electric power and utilities, that's important enough to society in New Hampshire that we regulate that. It's a regulated industry at the state and federal level because it's a key enough function. However, another key function, education, it's all over the place. Nobody is willing to give up the federal money for building educational infrastructure, but we sure don't want the federal government involved in policy decisions.
Charlie?
Well, roads is the classic example of this, right, where we collect all the money locally. Roads are paid for by your gas tax. The money is then sent to a giant bureaucracy in Washington, D.C. There's this enormous, ugly building in Southeast D.C. where they then take a cut off the top and make all kinds of decisions and then send some of it back to us, where then we build the roads. Nobody wants to give that up exactly, but everyone knows that the roads are better done at the state level. And then if you think about the local level, my road is more likely to get paved if they aren't making decisions in Concord, where some guy who really wants a train can make sure my bridge doesn't get fixed and we get a train. And some guy who wants his bridge fixed can't make sure my road doesn't get fixed.
Well, guys, this has been really interesting. Dean Spiegel, this last quick question for you. Do we keep arguing about this 10 years from now, 100 years from now?
I think for a long time to come. I think there's enough of kind of ideological overlay of polarized politics at all levels of politics that it's going to continue on for the foreseeable future.
Okay, well, Dean Spiliotis, Charlie Arlinghaus Buscher, thank you all very much for being here. I really appreciate it. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern is Karen Goll. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.